Good morning, everyone signing in. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. We are just going to wait another minute as I see lots of people jumping on the phone right now. So we're just going to wait till we have a full crowd and then we will get started. Thanks for your patience. All right, good morning and happy Friday. Thank you for joining us. I'm Pam from our development office, and we're so glad that you could be with us today. I am now gonna turn it over to Dean Tomaselli to get the conversation started.
Thank you, Pam, and welcome everybody. We continue to do well in New York at keeping a resurgence of COVID-19 at bay. That's despite well over 21 million cases worldwide and 760,000 deaths. About 20% of those are deaths in the United States, and we are vigilant because the number of cases in the United States exceeds 5 million, and we need to be on guard to prevent another resurgence locally in the New York area, which could occur at any time. However, I would say, having gone through what we've gone through in March through May, I think we are a lot better prepared should we have a re-entry of the virus into our area. That being said, we have started to resume activity in a bit more normal way, both at the health system and at the College of Medicine with more elective procedures. We have started to have a bit more activity on the medical school campus as well. And indeed, we this week are in the middle of orientation week for our first year medical students, the class of 2024, believe it or not. Research on COVID-19 on campus actually continues to be robust. We've been working on therapeutic development, both small molecules and antibodies, as well as being engaged in the clinical trials of convalescent plasma, as well as remdesivir and other immunomodulating agents. And those trials are going well. The importance of being able to robustly, early, and accurately diagnose COVID-19 can't be overstated. It's clear that early diagnosis and the ability to treat early is going to be important in minimizing the impact of COVID-19. Today, we're lucky to have with us Dr. Michael Lipton. Michael is the Associate Director of the Gruss Magnetic Resonance Research Center, a professor of radiology, and the Director of MRI Services at Montefiore Medicine. His group has been engaged in a very interesting project to try and better understand radiography in this disease and to use digital techniques, artificial intelligence, deep learning, and others to improve diagnosis and prognostication along with other clinical data in patients infected with SARS-CoV-2. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Dr. Lipton and welcome him and thank him for joining us today to provide a little bit of insight on COVID-19. So Michael?
Thank you, Dr. Tomaselli. It's a pleasure and I appreciate the invitation. Just to make a quick introductory comment. So I'm a radiologist. Meaning, I do clinical work with patients at Montefiore and also a researcher. My focus actually is on the brain. And this project that I'll talk to you about briefly is, I think, is another example about how many of us in the system have really, in this case, I would say, expanded the scope of our focus to try to bring expertise to bear on things that might actually be a little bit outside of our usual area. And in this project, you know, I'm collaborating with multiple individuals, both at Montefiore as well as outside Montefiore, including Dr. Jeffrey Levski in the radiology department, where I'm bringing some of my methodological and research expertise to bear with a different clinical problem, which really addresses the key questions, not so much about the diagnosis of COVID-19 per se, but really being able to most effectively manage patients. And a big question that we have is when a patient is in the hospital and is diagnosed with COVID-19, how do we determine what the trajectory of need for care and the likely outcome is going to be in that individual? And as the dean just mentioned, it's very important to be able to early on understand when we need to apply interventions, including some of the novel approaches that are being studied at Montefiore and Einstein. And a couple of the specific questions are, which patients are going to need to have intensive care and ventilatory support? And how can we determine who is at higher risk for a worse outcome, including not surviving, as well as those who are not at high risk? And that really bears not just on the care of the patient, which it certainly does, but also on allocation of resources. And, you know, at Montefiore and Einstein, really being at ground zero of this pandemic, which fortunately, as we just heard, we're hopefully emerging from that in an enduring way. But we really dealt extensively with allocation and creation of resources to deal with these patients. So the project that I specifically wanted to present a little bit of a sort of a preview to you on, and this we were very fortunate to be funded through Dean Tomaselli's office to essentially address these questions as to how can we best predict which patients are going to need this ventilatory support, and what is the likely prognosis? Now, the problem here, aside from the simple fact that COVID-19 is a deadly disease for which we're still trying to understand how we can most effectively treat it, is that in the setting of a patient coming into the hospital with COVID, there is a huge amount of information that the physicians caring for the patient have at their disposal, everything from blood tests to their oxygenation to their what their needs are in terms of other body systems, even besides lung function. And some of that also involves imaging. It's very typical for these patients to have chest x-rays, and the chest x-rays actually show rather dramatic findings in many but not all patients. The problem is that even though we have all of this information available, none of these individual pieces of information have proven effective in differentiating and giving a window into what the future holds for a given patient, and therefore they're not able to help us really understand in a sort of future looking manner what their care needs are going to be. And the reason for this is that it's simply not the case that any one piece of information, say the amount of oxygen required or the finding on a chest x-ray, by itself is really not sufficient to answer the question. And this really gets to the sort of futuristic aspect of the project, which is that we're bringing to bear new approaches which really take a novel approach to the way we consider data in clinical research. And the typical approach is that we have a hypothesis at the outset that there are specific features or specific measurements that we're going to test whether or not those, that set of things that we know about the patient, let's just say, for example, their chest x-ray status and their oxygen requirement and their blood pressure. And we're going to test how those numbers predict what the outcome of the patient is. The problem is that we don't actually know in this case that those three things or any other set of things are the keys to answering the question. And so the approach that we're taking, which is sometimes referred to as a data-driven approach, utilizes machine learning and artificial intelligence, which are ways to take very large amounts of data and to identify the set of what we call features or the set of, for example, clinical test results, or in a chest x-ray, what it is about the appearance of the chest x-ray that tells us something important about whether this patient is going to recover on their own, whether they're going to need to be on a ventilator, how long they'll need to be on a ventilator, and what their prognosis is likely to be. And so this involves collecting a large amount of data. And in thinking about this particular project, which uses a common test, a portable chest x-ray, which can be taken using a machine that's wheeled around the hospital and can be taken at the patient's bedside and is typically visually interpreted by a radiologist, simply identifying if and if so where there are abnormalities in that chest x-ray. In this case, we're actually taking that chest x-ray, which is a digital picture, and we're treating it as essentially a matrix or an array of numerical data. And rather than having an individual human expert, a radiologist, simply review that, those x-rays, whether it's at one point in time or preferably at multiple points in time, can be analyzed by a computer, which takes this massive amount of data and identifies the set of findings or features that are effective in predicting the outcome for the patient. So it, you know, it all sounds very exciting, and it is very exciting, but I just wanted to point out that so artificial intelligence in medicine, certainly artificial intelligence in general, is not new. And artificial intelligence has been applied and studied extensively in medicine and in radiology in particular. And we're in fact, even before COVID, we're in an era where there's really an explosion of these types of data-driven machine learning approaches to research questions. But it's important to understand that there are many, many approaches and algorithms that have been developed and described and published for diagnosis using artificial intelligence. There is at the same time a lot of criticism of many of these techniques in the way that they have been applied. And what I mean by that is that it's actually relatively easy to develop an algorithm and apply it to a small set of data. But it turns out that to really know whether these algorithms are useful requires a much deeper dive into their functionality. And it turns out that as much as the actual computer algorithm is important, the data that are fed into that algorithm are even more important. And a large part of the project that we're fortunate to be pursuing here is about what we call curating, just like in a museum, those data points, and really ensuring that the data quality is sufficient and that the size of the data set that we have is sufficient. Being at Montefiore and Einstein, given our location and the how much coronavirus was going on here, how many patients came through the medical center, we're actually in a very good position to address that. Although at the same time, this will also work with other national and international efforts to try to pool data and make sure that when we then test our algorithms, that we're really testing them in a way that will give meaningful results that we can then hopefully use for patients. I just wanted to take a minute to mention another research direction that I am pursuing, which is a little bit outside of what is most widely recognized about the coronavirus 19 disease, which we generally think of as a respiratory disease, and it is predominantly a respiratory disease. But it turns out that there are many reasons to suspect that there are actually effects on the brain of people who have coronavirus disease. And in part, that may just because these patients are critically ill. But in addition to that, there are patients who don't have critical illness, but seem to have neurological effects. And relating to a large research focus of my own, which is detecting relatively subtle effects of injury to the brain and how those can affect someone's functioning. We're looking at a cohort of patients that have been previously studied here at Montefiore Einstein and looking at what the incremental effect on brain function is in those individuals. And what I'm getting at is that many people won't necessarily recognize the effect of an injury or illness on their brain functioning. Early on in disease, a lot of the symptoms that people have are really flying under the radar. And there's actually some interesting data in the news just yesterday from the CDC that psychiatric morbidity is likely to be a major problem in the wake of COVID-19. And so our approach here is to use some advanced methods for imaging the brain and testing brain function to look at trying to identify what these sort of subclinical effects are that will potentially lead to significant morbidity and difficulty in functioning with patients who we otherwise might not have expected it.
Terrific. Michael,
and I'm happy to take any questions. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great synopsis. And I do have a couple of issues and items. So AI has been used in a variety of other diseases. Perhaps you could give us your impression and take on how, depending upon, and maybe in your field, it performs, specifically comparing it to medical intuition, for example, where we are currently in the state of things using artificial intelligence and deep learning techniques.
Sure. So this is actually a very, very pertinent question in my particular clinical field in radiology, where there have been some very provocative studies. They've even been reported in the New York Times about comparing the performance of a physician, a clinical radiologist, actually in looking at a chest X-ray, to an algorithm, to simply taking those images and feeding them into a computer system. And there are, you know, there is sort of this concept that, well, machines will be able to do this better than people. And, you know, my response to that would be that ultimately, I don't think we actually know the answer to the question as to whether that's true. But, you know, artificial intelligence has been used in supporting diagnosis for quite some time. I think in radiology in particular, in breast imaging and looking at mammography, it has quite a long history of using what has been called computer-aided diagnosis. But one of the things that we've learned is that the algorithm output is far from foolproof. And it really, what it is doing, rather than replacing a physician's judgment, what it really is doing is facilitating the more effective use of clinical, as the dean just said, intuition or reasoning. In other words, as medicine has progressed, we have massive amounts of data at our disposal. And it gets to the point where it's simply not feasible for us to really leverage all of that information. But at the end of the day, the diagnosis doesn't come down simply to the output of an algorithm. That needs to be put into context and understood, and it needs to be vetted to be sure that it's actually reliable. There's a lot of skepticism out there as to some of the AI or artificial intelligence algorithms that have been put forth that may have more questionable validity and might be useful at some point, but are being perhaps pushed ahead too quickly.
Yeah, I would agree. In my field, Michael, I've been reading electrocardiograms that have been read by a computer for decades, and they do a good job with normal electrocardiograms, but not such a great job when they're abnormal. So I would agree,
yep.
A little bit of ways to go.
Yeah.
I had a question about utilization of AI and other techniques, not on a patient-by-patient basis, but do you think there's a role in the population in helping us control not an individual affected with disease, but, for example, flattening the curve and controlling disease spread, and what might be the methods that are available to actually do that?
Yeah, so I mean, that's an area where I think that there is a lot of potential, and there actually are already some studies, albeit preliminary studies. Early on in China, there were some utilizations of AI in using not necessarily only medical data, but actually looking at location data. So there have been studies that looked at the spread of infection, for example, within settings like restaurants and outdoor spaces. And I think that that is really potentially useful in terms of understanding mechanisms of spread. But I think that there are also really opportunities for looking across a population at understanding what is the likelihood that we are seeing trends that, again, are sort of flying below the radar, but maybe indications that something is brewing. And I think that as we look at things that are relatively crude in terms of the numbers of cases, the numbers of deaths, the mortality rates, et cetera, that we take those as potentially indicators of something coming. But at the same time, I think it really cuts both ways. You know, there was recent work from Einstein by Aviv Bergman showing that some of these trends may actually be created by artifacts about the way the data are reported. At the same time, I think that we may not be really looking at a complete enough data set. In China, there has been, you know, a lot of use of something that would be tough in the United States, you know, using surveillance cameras to assess compliance with things like masking and trying to understand how behaviors like masking impact other behaviors that can affect spread. So I think there's a lot of opportunity, but there's a lot of work to go. And of course, if we had more access to more widespread testing, that could certainly be mined and looked at to identify trends in the way things are moving across the population.
Great. Perhaps I can ask you finally to expand a little bit on some of the work that you've been doing on the brain, maybe not related to COVID, but to subtle traumatic brain injury and how that manifests itself and how you've been able to use similar methods to make these types of diagnoses.
Right. So, you know, my longstanding interest is to try and understand how subtle injury to the brain is something that can lead to adverse effects on brain structure and function. And specifically, you know, I've focused on for quite a long time on the area of trauma, both concussion as well as more recently focused on repeated impacts to the head in athletes and in particular in soccer players. And what we do is use some advanced imaging techniques and some sophisticated ways to assess cognitive performance and behavioral performance to really try and understand almost like the dose of injury that it takes to adversely affect someone's brain. And the point here is that there is some amount of, in the use case that I'm focusing on in soccer players, there's some amount of impacts to the head that are probably well tolerated by most people. But when you get above a certain level, and that level still remains to be fully understood, then there becomes increasing risk for both subclinical and then clinical effects on brain function. So something, someone doing an activity like being an active soccer player and repeatedly hitting their head against the ball, which we generally historically have thought of as being pretty innocuous unless it causes a concussion. But what we're talking about here is that even people who do not sustain a concussion, that we can actually show measurable effects on both their brain structure and their brain function, which evolve and may get worse over time in proportion to the number of impacts on the head. And I think even more importantly, we're starting to discover how it is that individual characteristics of people, such as their genes, such as sex differences, and such as other background features, modify the risk. And the goal here is really to understand how the brain responds to low levels of injury. And this really, you know, on the one hand has nothing to do with COVID, but at the same time, the project I mentioned a few minutes ago is really focused on the idea that there are many things which people are exposed to which may cause effects on their brain that lead to adverse impact on functioning, which are not always clearly recognizable to the individual. So if you think about, for example, a student who is trying to do their best in school and get into the best college they can, they may never have a concussion, but if they're having these repeated impacts to the head, they might have, and we don't know that this is the case, but they might have an alteration in their brain integrity and function that could put their level of functioning lower than where it might have been otherwise. And I think similarly, and we think about people who have had coronavirus infection and have not been seriously ill, not even been hospitalized. What are the effects on their brain, given the fact that we know that the coronavirus does enter the nervous system? That's really unknown based on symptoms that have been reported and some other data. I think there's more than enough reason to suspect that there is something that may be floating below the radar that remains to be discovered and understood and addressed. So that's the focus is really, again, on trying to understand things in the environment, whether they're trauma, whether they're an infection, whether they're related to normal aging or development, and how those affect brain structure and function at a very low level that is not necessarily insignificant in the long run for people's functioning.
Well, that's absolutely fascinating, Michael. Thank you very much for joining us today. And I want to thank everybody on the call for joining us, and in particular, the pilot study that we've been able to fund for Dr. Lipton is only possible because of the support provided by people who are interested in what we do. So again, thank you all very much for your support. I want to wish everybody a great weekend, and we'll speak again soon. Thank you.
Thank you.